supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Hey, ask parents if their children make them happy. Well, you'll get an interesting range of responses. Some might say they delight in the everyday interactions they have with their children, the small moments, the bliss, the laughter. After a moment of reflection and a sigh, they might add that their lives are hampered by too much responsibility, that their relationship with their partners changed, that there's no longer time for themselves, that they've lost something inside. Well, a recent article in New York Magazine brings up what many of us acknowledge, that becoming a parent does not automatically lead to happiness. In fact, a lot of research suggests the opposite is true, and many parents find they're just unprepared for the hard part. So that's what we're talking about on today's show, children and their effect on parents' happiness, the good news and the bad news. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear the good news and the bad news. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Rita DeMaria, Stephanie Kuntz, and Jennifer Senior. This show idea was based on an article Jennifer Senior wrote entitled, in New York Magazine, entitled All Joy and No Fun, Why Parents Hate Parenting. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined on this telephone by Stephanie Kuntz. She's a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College. She's the director of research and public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And Rita DeMaria is here in the studio with me. She's a couples family therapist here in the Philadelphia and Director of Relationship Education at the Council for Relationships. She's the co-author of The Seven Stages of Marriage. Rita, hi. Welcome back to the show. You were here over a decade ago.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Jennifer, let's start with you. Your article opens up by talking about your own frustration and your happiness with your 2.5-year-old son, who was acting, well, like a 2.5-year-old. So are you in that category of women who are less happy than you were before?
Well, you know, if I tell you the category that I'm in, I'll be leaping ahead to the end of the story and sort of some of the conclusions. So it's up to you whether you want me to say it now. Most of the studies that look at this question suggest that people are less happy, and it sort of doesn't matter whether they're big longitudinal studies from the UK that are based on general health questionnaires, or whether they're more focused studies that were done here in the United States, either by Daniel Kahneman, who's this behavioral economist at Princeton. But there was this superbly designed study that I found that I mentioned at the end of the piece that tried to make a distinction between how happy we were sort of day to day, that looked at our stress levels and things like this, and then measured depression and said that actually married women were less depressed. They were less happy but less depressed, if you could make that distinction, that they might have worried more and argued more with their spouses and felt like they had less control, but that they also were less depressed, which is to say that I think they walked around with more of a sense of existential purpose, and I definitely fall into that category.
Boy, I'll tell you, when you talked about that apparent contradiction, less happy but less depressed. I just had a flashback to Tevye, you know, and Fiddler on the Road.
Yeah,
and the song Do You Love Me? Well, why is that relevant? You know?
Do I what? Yeah.
We have a life here. It's
right.
A life.
That's exactly. Yeah, exactly. Am I happier? Am I what? You know, exactly. I think that there's a real parallel there. That's right. I mean, that sort of spools way ahead to where the piece sort of lands. But I mean, if I were to isolate, you know, sort of how it was that I felt personally, I think that's where I would come in. I think that's, you know, how I would evaluate my own personal feelings about it.
Well, then I have to say, now that we've come to the conclusion, I want to thank all three of you for joining us next week on the show. Well, you alluded to this article by Daniel Kahneman, where he surveyed nearly 1,000 women in Texas and found, with 1,000 women, that childcare ranked 16th in the pleasurability rating out of 19 activities. So we know about the biological imperative to have children, but if everybody on the planet were this unhappy, you know, our roads would be less congested.
Right. I mean, I think what's interesting is that happiness is not necessarily an evolutionary incentive. I mean, there are many things that incentivize us before happiness does, including things like fear, right? So that's not really, clearly that's not how it works out, or at least moment-to-moment happiness. But Kahneman's study was very interesting because the women who were responding were not told explicitly that what they were, it's not like these, you know, researchers were looking to see whether they were happy as mothers, right? I mean, they were simply asking them to sort of reconstruct their days and to rate their pleasurability, how pleasurable they found certain activities. The fact that childcare managed to come in like just after housework, you know, I mean, and a million other things like napping and watching TV, they didn't know that this is how they were sort of organizing things and evaluating things. It just wound up that way. But again, what science can't necessarily capture, what social science can't capture, are deeper questions about meaning, you know, and what this all means to you. You know, I'm sure that people who were serving in World War II didn't like, you know, starving and getting frostbite, but I'm sure at the end of their lives they were very proud to have, you know, stopped the Germans, you know. So, right. I mean, again, you know, there's limits to how social science can evaluate these questions.
Reed, I want to turn to you. We're talking about some of the research that shows children reduce marital satisfaction. And there was one study that Jennifer cited that shows that parents often are more depressed than non-parents, whether they're single or not. So what could be done to mitigate this risk of depression?
Well, I think one of the tremendous challenges is time. You know, when you have a busy life, a child, two child, depending on toddlers, time, and when you don't have time for yourself to get the support that you need, to get exercise, to eat well, to get enough sleep, that does create depression. So the busyness of parenting in that time of life, when the demands are usually very, very high, are a big factor.
I want to take a minute to put in a shameless plug for next week's show, which is going to be about coping with external stressors. But you talk about time, so time is limited. What can we do about that?
Well, we have to get our priorities, and this is where the relationship of the couple is important. I think Jennifer talked about how couples were less happy but also less depressed, and that perhaps there was conflict in the couple. In the book, The Seven Stages of Marriage, the cooperation stage is the stage in which people are building a home, careers, having children, building a life together. And it's really important for some emphasis to be on, number one, the personal needs I just mentioned, but also the relationship needs for the couple. And the couple needs support and the individuals need support because parenting is hard work and childcare demands are demands.
Well, you know, it's back to the theme of it takes a village. We, as a culture, we know from all the wonderful research by social science that we are becoming more and more isolated. Our number of intimate friends we have is shrinking. Men now have on the average of one, if that, and women have three, and that number's down over a decade. So we're more isolated, and we can't rely just on a spouse to be everything for
Absolutely.
Us and to raise children. I want to turn to you, Stephanie. You suggest when we spoke to you earlier in some of your writings that a lot of this distress is about the expectations we bring to both marriage and child rearing, and that healthy planning changes everything. So what are reasonable expectations?
Well, I think that, as both of your other guests have pointed out, you cannot expect to get everything from one person or two people or even your own nuclear family to have constant happiness. I think the question, and this is a really important one in so many areas of life, you know, when Jennifer was describing child rearing, and as a parent I was totally relating to that, you know, the years just rush by, and a bad moment can feel like an eternity. So it really is a high pressure kind of thing. But I also thought it's a little like writing a book, you know. There's just this sense of despair at times in writing a book, and it's so hard work, but at the end you do feel you've accomplished something. And with a child, I think that's true too. But I think that we've got to get away from this idea that every should get that this romanticization of either marriage or child rearing. And I think it's particularly hard in child rearing right now, that in some ways, of course, our higher standards are good. We're more democratic in, you know, I think it's good that we're more democratic, that we expect to be closer to our kids as they age. But in another way, I think this idea of turning your kids into a full-time project is neither good for the kids nor for the couple. In fact, there's been a tremendous reduction in couple time just with each other, 40% reduction, Paul Amato found, just since 1980, because parents are multitasking so much, going in separate directions with the kids to provide them with all these teachable moments and enriching experiences. And so they're losing time with each other, and as you pointed out a few minutes ago, they're losing even more time with the neighbors and support systems and friends and extended kin who could actually help them enjoy this process a little more.
So, like with most, we have found the problem, and the problem lies between our ears. So the question is, what can we do to fix that? So we're gonna talk about that and many other dimensions of this issue after our break. We are talking about our children and their effects on parents' happiness, and of course, vice versa. We'll be taking your calls right after this next break. Our number is 888-477-9499. Tell us how your children have affected your life, your feelings about your life, your marriage. 888-477-9499. My guests are Rita DeMaria. She's a marital and family therapist here in Philadelphia. She's here in the studio. On the telephone is Jennifer Senior. She's a reporter and author of a New York Magazine article, All Joy and No Fun, Why Parents Hate Parenting. And Stephanie Kuntz, she's a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival brings Richard Thompson, Taj Mahal, Jeff Tweedy, Bonnie Prince Billy, and many more to the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford for the weekend of August 20th through the 22nd for concerts, crafts, camping, and children's activities. The Philadelphia Folk Festival, 3 days, 6 stages, over 60 musicians. Details at 1-800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Gary Steingart's new novel is a romance set in a future New York City where America is in chaos. We're at war with Venezuela, corporations have merged beyond recognition, and armies of the poor have taken over Central Park. The book is called Super Sad True Love Story. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about our children and do they make us happy or the opposite? And of course, it's a little bit of both. But we're reviewing some of the research and some of the experience with Jennifer Senior, who wrote All Joy and No Fun, Why Parents Hate Parenting in the New York Magazine. Stephanie Kuntz joins us by phone. She's Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families. Rita DiMaria is a couples and family therapist here locally, and she's the co-author of The Seven Stages of Marriage. Jennifer, before we took our break, we were talking with Stephanie about unreasonable expectations that parents bring, that people bring to both marriage and raising children. Do you recall what were your expectations going into both marriage and child rearing?
Appropriately, by the time I had my child, because I was 38. So on the one hand, you know, I know that, you know, the longer you wait, the kind of more startled you are by how much independence you lose. But at the same time, because I was the last person on the block to have a baby, I didn't have many, you know, delusions about it. This said, when Stephanie was speaking, my brain was just screaming, yes, yes, exactly, yes. And I wrote about this at Lent in the piece. I think some of the expectations are, and as she was sort of implying, I mean, they are actually a legitimate kind of internalized fear response to the, you know, kind of shrinking economic pie. People feel like they have to, you know, that they're cultivating their children within an inch of their lives, in part simply because they are afraid of what it looks like for their children to live on the less fertile side of the economic divide. I've just used a horribly mixed metaphor, forgive that. But, you know, and I think that that's some of this. And some of it is just, you know, kind of a certain neuroticism and narcissism of a certain generation raising children. Every moment doesn't have to be teachable. You don't have to sit there and aggressively tutor your children in Mandarin. It's okay to sort of put them in the next room, and I think people don't feel like they can do that, and it's not clear to me that kids are benefiting from that kind of, you know, aggressive sculpting. And also, I think everyone is right when they're pointing out that now there's a lot of pressure on the nuclear family to sort of replicate the effects that a more tightly knit culture once brought, an extended family once brought. The mere fact of living in gigantic houses, you know, where there's only one other kid or no other children in them, and kids aren't biking around in the street, is problematic. I think parents feel immense pressure just to cultivate them in that way.
Well,
also, yeah.
I want to forewarn Rita that I need to go to the phones because a lot of people want to join the conversation. I just want to forewarn Rita that right after this phone call, you're the clinician, Rita. You're going to tell us how to fix it.
Okay.
You're the clinician. I'm the radio host. Let's go to Hollis on the line. Hey, Hollis.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
This conversation is so interesting because I'm the parent of two teenagers. They're twins. And my husband and I think, have found over the years that although every day may not be exactly happy, overall, because we have to communicate and have to collaborate on things concerning our kids, it's made us more interesting people, I mean, to each other, because we work together.
Kind of like you have a common enemy?
on some days, it kind of feels like that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You said that you find yourselves more interesting people to each other. I think, Jennifer, I think it was in your article that you said that parents often feel the opposite, that as parents they just wind up just talking and thinking about, you know, diapers and play dates and things like that, that they find themselves less interesting.
I didn't actually say less interesting. I mean, I think I said that there was one, again, very well-designed study that I quoted that said that 40% of all arguments between parents are about their kids. And those are the ones that are explicitly, in this study, that were explicitly about the kids. I mean, forgetting about the subtext in, say, an argument about finances or not having enough sex or whatever else, you know, I mean, that this was actually, you know, about the kids alone. It sounds like your caller has a good marriage. Also, I think what I had said is that, you know, I think in the case of many marriages, particularly in the beginning, people are blindsided, that small perforations can turn into real fault lines.
If I could
interject. Please jump in. This is your field of expertise. It's hardly mine.
Yes, Stephanie?
Well, from my point of view, I think that the parental alliance is really, really important, and it sounds as though these two have it. One of the things that research does show is that when parents really agree from the moment of conception about having a child, what they want from a child, and what they want to do as parents, that's a very good predictor that their marital quality will fall less than the usual sort of decline that happens.
But I
do think that it's really important to the extent that you can agree about what you want from the kids, but also that you can continue to have a life outside the kids. I think that's very important.
Well, I want to turn to you, Rita, and I would think that parents who have that discussion Stephanie just referred to before they conceive, they've got a pretty good marriage to begin with. You know, they've got a healthy perspective.
Well, they have a good start, I would say. I think what Hollis is talking about and what I heard and what she shared is they became a parenting team over time and that they grew together. Regardless of where they started, they grew together. Mm. They got to know each other more. They've learned more about each other. They've probably learned more about their weaknesses, their values, their beliefs about life, about each other. And I think that's what contributes to people becoming more interesting to each other over time in a marriage. I think that's the positive news about marriage that we don't often talk about, because when people have communication skills, they communicate it.
So, Hollis, do we still have you?
Yes, you do. And I do want to make it clear, though, that I think, you know, at different stages in your children's lives, you know, you're going to interact with them differently and pull out different skills or different ways of reasoning that, you know, for different situations. So certainly when our children were quite young, it wasn't all that great at times. Right. And it did take a long time. And now that they're teenagers, although we have a whole different set of, you know, circumstances ahead of us, you know, I think you just adjust to each stage. But certainly I would say that when they were small, that was probably the hardest time for us.
Right. And so the commitment was maintained. I'm sure you had some fun along the way. You probably had some dates. You maintained some focus on your marriage. You knew you had to communicate. You know, you get two people who just are conflict avoiders, and they pull away.
So let's talk about that, Hollis. One final question of you. Is that the case? Did the two of you communicate? Did you have fun during the difficult times?
Well, we were very fortunate because we no longer had the situation, but at the time we were living in a place where both our parents were, and we had many opportunities where we could have time to ourselves because the grandparents would take the kids.
There you go.
That's support.
And it made a world of difference.
That's what all of us are saying. Hollis, thanks so much.
I'd like to make a point about, you know, children grow up, but parents grow up. And couples grow up together. And
hopefully.
Ideally. I think but that ultimately helps determine whether people are going to consider their experience as a parent happy or not. Because happiness has a lot of different points of view depending on how you're looking at it.
I wonder, and I guess I'll turn to you, Jennifer. Do parents ever ask themselves, was I really happy before I had kids? You know, we all, when we're living in stressful times or even stressful moments, we romanticize yesterday. So, you know, I wonder if there's any way to look at that.
It's a good question, but, I mean, I'll give you just the answer from the social science point of view in terms of how the data was collected. That would be a very subjective way of doing things. These things, the better studies are longitudinal, where they're looking at people's affect and asking questions before and then asking questions after. Or they're looking at, you know, people who more or less have the same demographic profile, they just don't have kids, but they're roughly the same age, they're the same race, they're the same class, they're the same gender. And that's the way they tend to look at it. And unbeknownst to the people who are answering, the parents tend to be less happy. That's the way that they look at it. And again, you know, so, I mean, of course, yes, you know, if you talked, I mean, like I said, I was 38 when I had my kid. I felt very much like I really wanted a kid, and I felt like one of the sources of my, you know, unhappiness was that I didn't have one. I wasn't in sync with my cohort. I felt sort of ashamed to be waking up and not have some larger sort of thing, project to sacrifice myself to and apply myself to. That was something for me. But, you know, what's interesting is that the way these studies are done, for whatever reason, they tend to show different answers.
I am curious. I want to come back to you, Stephanie, and the issue of expectations prior to having a child. You know, the research shows when we fall in love with romantic love, it releases oxytocin in the brain. And one of the byproducts of that, of this trust hormone, is that it actually impairs your judgment so that you are not able to see the flaws in your lover. That you tend to overlook them. And without that, maybe nobody would ever get married. So I wonder if something like that is going on with parents, that maybe there is some neurochemical need, you know, to have children, and we need to see it with rose-colored glasses going in.
Well, I'm certainly not a biological expert, but I think parenting is a little bit like childbirth. If we all remember just how much it hurt, I don't think there'd be any second child in any family.
But the chemistry of bonding is important.
Pardon?
The chemistry of bonding is there.
Absolutely. And I think that you're right that it has a paradox, because the chemistry of trusting, giving yourself, being able to put yourself over to someone also does stand in the way of your thinking about things that may be more difficult in the future, whether it's a mate, whether this trait is actually going to wear well over time, and whether it's if it's a kid, you know, there's this sort of a pleasurable denial of the fact that a lot of this will be unpleasant. I think that's a very important part of life that we do. But, you know, I think that there are certainly ways to reduce the unhappiness that is, and planning in advance, having a good parental alliance, having things outside the family. You know, I want to go back to what Jennifer said earlier, that we have really ramped up our expectations of parenting so much that it's very, I think, stressful for people in ways that perhaps it wasn't in the past, although I don't think child rearing has ever just been fun. And I think Jennifer was right, too, that maybe happiness as a, you know, fleeting kind of thing isn't the most important source of satisfaction in people's lives, and that if you're mature enough to recognize that, ironically, you'll be happier with your parenting.
Well, you know, before we took our break, Stephanie, I threatened to have Rita tell us how to fix it, and I'm still going to do that. But before that, I want you, as the historian, to tell us how we got here. How did we get so crazy as parents, as a culture?
Well, you know, part of it is good. Part of it is that we pay more attention to, we care more about our kids. You know, 150 years ago, kids were economic assets. You know, people didn't fight over custody. They fought in terms of, oh, I want to spend time with the child. They fought over the right to the child's labor when there were arguments. And at that time, you know, yes, kids brought some joy to people, but they were not this project, and they were there was not a thought that it was up to parents to cultivate them or to even respect their opinions. So some of these changes have been very important and very good. But in the last 30 years, we've really ramped up our expectations for reasons that Jennifer talked about. You know, what's one of the things that's really interesting, we debate about whether working moms or whether you should stay home. Today, working moms spend more time interacting with their kids than homemaker moms did back in 1965, the height of the male breadwinner family. And one of the things that's interesting about this is that educated couples in particular have ramped up their time tremendously. And there's a recent study comparing Canadians and Americans. Now, all Canadian parents from all different classes have increased the time they spent with their kids, but they've increased it modestly. There hasn't been this huge, huge increase that we saw that we've seen in the last 15 years for educated couples. And these economists suggested that it has to do with the steeper educational hierarchy and prestige structure in the United States. In Canada, you get your kids off to college. It doesn't really matter. They can go to the same province. You don't have to pick one of the top five. But Americans are, for exactly the reason Jennifer was talking about earlier, just desperate to get their kids into the highest status one. And I think that leads to some of the craziness, too. Mm.
So we come back to you, Rita. You know, we talk, and it's easy to talk about you've got to stop this or you've got to start that. But we've got lifestyles. We've got a way of living and a way of being. We've got our identities. As delusional as we are about them. So to tell someone to stop or to expand or to change, it's not going to work. It's going to feel good when we say it and everybody's going to nod their heads, but it's not going to make any change.
Well, I'm an advocate for people sharing in groups, having peer support, having educational support, because that helps us to sort of step out of where we are and look at the situation, get some new information, maybe a technique, a skill, something. It's a wonderful phenomenon. We also begin to realize that we're all more similar than not, and that I may be struggling, but so is my neighbor, and so is this other person. Look at this dad. And getting people to just share in that common awareness of what the challenges of parenting are all about.
It's interesting. Moms often have that with playdate. Moms are much more likely to connect with other moms.
Fathers are starting. There's a huge fatherhood movement, and men do recognize, and men actually like the support. That's, you know, they just do it a little differently. They have their softball league or their other kinds of sports or activities or fishing or just different things. But that bonding and that connection and that social support and how's it going and, oh, what was it like? You know, men do that too.
I was watching two guys at a lake, and they were in their trunk, and they were, you know, pulling out their fishing rods, and they're sitting at the lake. And I turned to the person I was with, and I said, do you think one of those guys picked up the phone and said to the other, hey, let's go sit by a lake this afternoon and talk? I mean, but
let's go
what
fishing.
Are they doing?
Right,
they're doing it.
And then the other thing is the couple relationship. So you need the parenting support and connection. You also need support and connection with other couples. And you have to take care of yourself.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Megan on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Megan.
How are you?
So far, so good. And you?
I'm doing all right. I've been listening, and I hear you guys talking about, you know, marital alliances and people's satisfaction with being parents. And no one's really addressed the issues that single parents face. I had my daughter when I was 16. I'm now 26. I'm a single mother, and I'm wondering, is it wrong for me to apply all the energy that I could be spending on, you know, like a relationship that I have with another adult or possibly the other parent of my child, and taking that energy and that stress and everything and applying it to my child, rather children now, I have two girls, to sort of I spend most of my time, instead of spending it on me, I do spend it on them, teaching them and sort of molding them. But I hear you guys say that that's not always benefiting children. I wanted to see if I could get your opinion.
Well, let me just ask you a question before I turn to the experts.
Okay.
Do you feel that what you are doing now is in some way harming you?
No.
Okay. Are you enjoying your life now?
I'm a generally happy person. I feel like I've had a difficult road, but I feel like I'm a strong person. I've tried to handle it, you know, as best I can. But my goal is to make my children's lives easier than mine has been.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's turn first to Rita here. So what are the issues for single parents? I mean, you know, Megan's right. You know, you talk about couples relationships, but a very large minority, there are no couples.
Right. I think my question is, who are the support people in her life? Also, I presume that she's working in some degree, and we've already heard that when you're working and then you come home, you want to give the attention to your children. So I think that positive voice that she's giving to the fact that she wants to be with her children and help them grow, et cetera, is good. But I can't help but wonder, who are the support people? Just because there's not a parental alliance or, you know, a couple relationship, I bet there are some people that are supportive,
Megan?
In her life.
Megan?
My parents are helpful. Right now I'm living in the Philadelphia area, and my nearest relative is in Atlanta, Georgia. So I'm sort of up here all on my own. But I think I'm really my own support system at this point.
Can I butt in here?
Yeah, please.
Here's a case where I think it's really important for Megan and people who are single parents to have support systems if they can possibly develop them, whether it's roommate, particularly when the children get to be adolescents, having somebody else who can back you up with discipline and stuff like that. Not necessarily a partner, though, and that's something that I think is really important. Our research is showing us that one of the worst predictors for kids' poor outcomes is a lot of turmoil, transition, or as Andy Cherwin calls it, churning in their lives. And sometimes our emphasis on the parental alliance or among the benefits of marriage can lead people to rush into new relationships in a way that is not good for the kids. So I think it's very important for you to develop as a support system as much as you can, but I think that there is nothing wrong with your decision to focus on raising your kids instead of pursuing a new relationship at this point in your life and their lives.
Yeah, I was essentially a single parent when my daughters were teenagers, and I remember issues coming up that I really needed to turn to someone for some feedback. And I said to my daughters when questions came up, often I would say, I'll get back to you on that. And, you know, I needed to call some people I trusted in my support system. So I think we all need that. And Megan, I hope you're able to generate that in your life. Meanwhile, I am thrilled for you and your children that you have the wiring, the attitude, and the outlook that you do. I wish you all great happiness. Thanks for calling the show. Well, we're gonna take a break. We're talking today about children and their impact on our happiness as parents, and what we can do to diminish the unhappiness we often feel and to increase our level of happiness, overall well-being. Our number is 888-477-9499. We do have a couple of lines open. That's 888-477-9499. My guests are Rita DeMaria, couples and family therapist here in Philadelphia. She's director of relationship education at the Council for Relationships. Jennifer Senior is an author, and she's written All Joy and No Fun, Why Parents Hate Parenting. It was in the New York magazine. And Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Mann Center for the Performing Arts supports WHYY and presents the Silk Road Ensemble with Yo-Yo Ma, August 11th, the New York Pops with Mark Nadler for an evening of Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, George Gershwin, and Fireworks, September 22nd. And on September 25th, the Mann welcomes the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia with incoming music director Dirk Brosset and pianist Gabriela Martinez. Tickets are available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
The U.S. Congress and disability rights groups are celebrating 20 years of success under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But what of the disabled from poor urban areas, often left to their own devices, those who don't have the access that others may enjoy even after the ADA was signed into law? You'll hear about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about our children today. And for once, we're not talking about how we affect them. We're talking about how they affect us. And we'd like to hear your story about that at 888-477-9499. My guests are Stephanie Kuntz. She's Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families. Jennifer Senior has written All Joy and No Fun, Why Parents Hate Parenting in New York Magazine. And Rita DeMaria is a local family therapist. She's Director of Relationship Education at the Council for Relationships. So we talk about time a great deal. And I'll turn to you, Stephanie. At the root of this lack of time is our stress and unhappiness. But isn't the difficulty not so much time, but the way we think about our lives more than the time problems? When we think about, you know, that our children need A, B, and C all the time, or that, you know, X, Y, and Z should happen, that's what sucks up time more than the clock does. It's our minds.
Well, I think it's I think there are a couple of things at work. I think in many cases that is true, that people, you know, don't prioritize the right things, don't understand when you can let something slide, when you should just kick back and enjoy the time you have instead of trying to turn it into some major investment in the future. So I think that's really important to understand. And in fact, we know that many people who have demanding jobs also feel that they are less stressed than other people because they do manage their time well. That said, I think we have to recognize that the United States has really one of the most backward time policies in terms of work than any other Western European country. First of all, we have very little parental leave time. We have no mandated vacations practically, whereas every other European country, people get a month off. And we know from research that it takes you a week or two to just get into vacation mode. So the kind of vacations that most Americans get when they're entitled to them at all are just ending at the point that they're just beginning to be able to recharge themselves.
And we also know, by the way, that people are giving back vacation time now for fear of losing their job. And those who take vacations are taking their laptops with them.
Exactly, because there is this sort of 24/7 approach to work availability in ways that other societies have not given into. Even things like part-time work, it's a kind of all-or-nothing situation in the United States. The penalties in Europe, you cannot pay people less per hour if they work part-time than they do full-time. But here, you can take up to a 40% cut
in your hourly pay if you drop to part-time. So it's really difficult. We also have a higher proportion of people working 50 hours a week or more than any of the European nations. And it's either you don't get enough work to be able to support your family, or you have to take on more work than you actually need financially just in order to keep the desirable job.
So are people in European countries happier parents?
Well, can I jump in? Yeah. Actually, Stephanie, I'm sure you know the answer to that, but that's where I was going to jump in.
Please do.
Yeah, that a lot of these studies, when replicated in the European countries with better cradle-to-grave benefits, all the parents come out happier. It's unambiguous. It's almost devastating to look at. And, in fact, the one study that I looked at that showed an unambiguous pickup in parental happiness was done with Danish subjects. But when Daniel Kahneman replicated his study of those nearly 1,000 Texas women, when he did the same thing with women in France versus Ohio, he looked at women in Rennes in France, and then Cleveland, I believe, or maybe it was Columbus. I think it was Columbus. Anyway, the women in France were much happier. There's subsidized childcare. There's, you know, much longer maternity leave. There's subsidized, you know, education's free, healthcare's free, or nearly so. And people have more civilized work hours. They commute less. They spend more time eating and walking.
All right, so we're comparing pretty poorly now to Europe, and we lost that comparative study with Canada, and we always lose comparative studies with Canada, which is right. Getting on my nerves. Rita?
The issue is time. So what can we do? What we have to do is put more time into our family, into our relationships. We have to understand how important it is and get some balance.
Well, when you say time,
yes.
I am in a unique position because I spend a lot of my professional time as a therapist counseling people who have experienced devastating illnesses and who are near death. Mm-hmm. And they hire me to escort them in this process. And you talk about time, it is then that they realize what is really important in life. And it is then that they realize that what's most important, they already have. It's right there.
So appreciating that, having those family dinners, even if they are simple, having them going to the park, going on dates. Couples will say, we don't have time for dates. Take a walk. Go out on your porch. Take those few minutes that you might have. One study showed that many couples don't spend more than 20 minutes a week talking to each other or connecting. I tell people, take a minute, two. Hugs are great. You get the chemistry along with that focused attention. That's what that's about, focused attention. Happiness is either in the moment, it's being engaged, or it's having a sense of meaning. So how do we maintain that in a busy life?
Hmm. Can I also just point out one thing, building on that?
Sure.
It's also the nature of the time. Fragmented time is really problematic, and we all have a lot of it now. We're, you know, because we're interrupted by Blackberries and we all check our email. My partner and I, he and I decided that we were just going to stop reading our emails, like at night. He and I made a decision to unplug the computers, essentially. And it's remarkable what a small, stupid difference that makes. But just also to pick up on something else, you know, the time itself, not just the attitude, but the time spent also really is problematic. I mean, you know, well-educated parents spend about, or the children of well-educated parents spend about 5 hours on average in structured activities. And if you think about the immense amounts of carpooling, the immense amounts of deadline work that involves, the kind of internal pressures you feel just to get your child to someplace, from someplace, back home, dinner cooked, then bedtime. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, informal deadlines in family life. So I'm going to argue that it's not just in our heads. It's real and it's external. Again, I'm not sure it's benefiting people as much as they'd like to think. You know, that study that just came out showing that helicoptering doesn't really seem to pay off, that kids actually have lower esteem at the end of it. I'm very interested in, I hope people keep looking at this question. I think it's important for us to sort out.
They are. They're actually, I do some work with disadvantaged families in the city with, you know, married, unmarried, single parents, non-custodial fathers. And the way they look at time is very different because they, you know, they don't have some of those travel pressures, the enrichment classes, all of those stresses. And one study actually came out and said that couples in that have a lower income spend much, much more time as a family and together. Now, their stresses often have to do with economics, mm-hmm. but I haven't really looked to see what the impact with children, but my guess would be they're much more settled with their children.
Mm. Final question. Jennifer, how do you like being a mom?
I do. I mean, you know, the funny thing is, some of it has nothing to do with anything but dumb luck. I mean, I'm a high-strung person. So is my partner. You know, we're both biologically wired a little bit toward the melancholic side. And we were handed this kid who's kind of cheerful and low-key. Go figure. So one of the immense surprises in all of this is has nothing to do with anything. It was purely a wild card. You know, how much I can chalk up at this moment to only that, you know. I mean, I think a lot of my pleasure just comes from seeing this difference, and also, frankly, it's just easier to parent a child who's like that.
One of my mantras is that our children have so much to teach us because they know stuff we have long since forgotten. And Jennifer, you make that point beautifully, that your child has so much to teach you about, you know, sitting and doing nothing and finding joy in a, you know, in a pencil or whatever. You
it's
know,
very strange that I actually find myself trying to, like, react to things the way he does, which is to say, sort of, you know, pleasantly.
That's one of the expectations about parenting. Most people have an expectation of their child. It doesn't work out.
Yeah, And my wish for you, my wish for all parents, is that we allow our children to be our teachers rather than trying to manage them. I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us today. Rita DeMaria is a family therapist locally, director of the Relationship Education at the Council for Relationship. Jennifer Senior writes for New York Magazine, and her article was called All Joy and No Fun, Why Parents Hate Parenting. Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College. Next week, we're going to be talking about stressors, like I said earlier, what they are and how we cope with them. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. Me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Al Banks has been the engineer. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer for audio content. Evan Pliss is our intern, Mike and Scott's our executive producer, and directed today's show. Jennifer Lynn is our producer.